With us tonight is Senator Hubert Humphrey, former Vice President of the United States, once more a candidate for the presidency. Senator Humphrey is running for the Democratic presidential nomination and is in Pittsburgh to address the AFL-CIO convention tomorrow at the Pittsburgh Hilton. You know, Senator, sometimes I don't know whether to call you Senator, Vice President, maybe a year from now we'll be saying Mr. President. Who knows?
Well, that's a happy thought. That's what we're working on right now, Bill.
I notice in the polls you keep inching up on the Democratic side, of the ledger. To what do you attribute that?
Well, I've been getting around the country a good deal, and of course announced my candidacy for the nomination in Philadelphia on the 10th day of January, and I believe then that people began to realize that I was a serious contender, and I believe that this has had some effect. Maybe I'm not what you call a sprinter, I'm a stretch runner, and I hope that we pace ourselves properly.
You look upon Pennsylvania more or less as a favorite state. Now, I know you carried this state 4 years ago, but now going into the Democratic nomination, we have Governor Schapp coming out for your leading opponent, you might say, Senator Muskie. Why would the governor win?
I don't know, but you know, I remember a few years ago that the governor had a slogan, "Man Against the Machine."
Right. And he was running.
Yes, I'm accepting that slogan now for myself, because after all, the state organization headed by the governor is not trying to be of too much help to me. So I'll just have to run against the machine here.
Senator, didn't Governor Schapp promise your people that he would stay neutral in this?
Well, it was my understanding that the governor would maintain a neutrality up through the primary, but I always understand the right of a man to change his mind. And quite candidly, this is not going to deter me a bit. I know that a governor can be of importance, but I have some very prominent people. I have a former governor and a very popular former governor, George Leader. I have a number of my friends from the labor movement. I have a goodly number of the Democratic leaders throughout the state of Pennsylvania. Plus the fact, I have a sort of a political love affair with this state. It's been good to me. This great county, Allegheny County, the city of Pittsburgh, has been very good to me politically. And I believe I talk the politics of the people of Pennsylvania. I'm acquainted with the state, with the needs of the people, the problems that confront the people, particularly the economic issues that are right up here in the forefront in Allegheny County. I noted that the rate of unemployment, for example, is going up here and it's getting to be very high, approaching the 7%, 6.8, around 7%, which is a very high rate of unemployment.
Well, not only in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, Senator, what would you look as the prime issue? Would you call it the economic factor?
I would. I think that the administration's mismanagement in the economic field is its major blunder, and it's a blunder that hasn't been corrected. It has been, it's been continuing. In fact, if anything, it's been getting worse. The workers, this is a great industrial state, Pennsylvania. They're losing jobs to foreign competition. A good deal of dumping is taking place. Our exports are falling off. Our imports are increasing. The dollar has been devalued. The balance of payments, which means the outflow of American dollars into other countries, has come at staggering proportions, well over $30 billion of dollars. But Bill, I remember when Kennedy was president, we had a $3 billion balance of payments deficit, and the Republican Party was screaming as if the country had gone into a total collapse. Now it's $30 billion of what we call balance of payments deficit. That's only a nice phrase for saying that's money that's left the country, gone someplace else, that ought to be used right back here in the United States to develop our own country.
Senator, briefly, why do you believe that you would be a better president than any one of the other candidates or nominees?
I think I've had the experience, and I believe this country needs a man of experience and a man that that has a sense of balance, that can face up to the tough problems. I think I've demonstrated that I can even face up to defeat. I didn't panic with defeat. I went back and went to work. I've been mayor of a great city of Minneapolis, and dealt with the problems of an urban center. I've been United States Senator, and didn't just serve in the Senate. If I may be immodest for a minute, I really passed a good deal of important legislation, everything from civil rights legislation to food stamp legislation to Medicare to amendments to Social Security, senior citizen housing, student fellowships, National Defense Education Act amendments. These are some of the things I've done. I've been Vice President of the United States, been very close to the presidency, served in the United Nations, negotiated for our country abroad. I have spent more time, I believe, than any elected official facing eyeball to eyeball with the Soviet officials. I believe I do know a little something about the world in which we live, and I'm prepared. I've prepared myself for the responsibilities that we're talking about.
But nevertheless, Senator, looking at it realistically, isn't it a tremendous uphill battle now to defeat President Nixon? He's not only the incumbent, but the trip to China and the upcoming trip to Moscow. I mean, if you look at it right there, don't you think it's a tremendous battle to try and defeat him?
Bill, I think one thing people want today is candor, and it is an uphill fight. I don't deny that a bit, but it was an uphill fight for me in 1968, and I came that close to winning. As a matter of fact, nobody really knew who was the president until the next morning after the election. It was a squeaker. Now, I figure that when a fellow gets so close that you can't hardly decide who won the rounds in a 15-round bout, he's entitled to a rematch. And I'm going back after it. And I feel that now, if here we are coming on into March, I had to start my campaign against Mr. Nixon in September of 1968 with no real organization, no money, with a party that was torn apart, with a disastrous picture at our convention, with the assassination of a great leader like Bobby Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with riots, with the war that had gone bad. That was the milieu, the environment in which I had to campaign, and I came that close, if I could measure it, of winning. I won vote in each voting precinct, and I would have been president. I'm ready to go back and do battle, and besides that, I feel better. I feel ready to go.
Well, you brought up the mention of money a moment ago. What do you feel will cost you just to get to the Democratic nomination? How many million, Senator?
That I really can't give you an accurate answer on, or even a good guess. I think it greatly depends upon how we do in the early primaries. If I could win these early primaries and get some momentum, I think that the amount of money that you have to spend will be minimal. If it's all a kind of a dead heat between several of us, between now and the California primary and the New York primary, it's going to be a very costly operation. Quite frankly, too, I think a lot of good Democratic contributors are not going to contribute as much as some of us thought they would, because they're going to hold their money for the general election, and I think they're right, because I want to see the Democratic nominee with the resources to defeat Mr. Nixon, and that's going to take some doing.
Well, Senator, thank you very much. Senator Hubert Humphrey in Pittsburgh to address the AFL-CIO convention tomorrow morning at the Pittsburgh Hilton, and the senator is now in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
You're very close to a schedule. Does this save you, Sigurd?
I don't work out the schedule. I argue sometimes about it if I don't like it too well, but I have a very competent woman in Washington that is the head of my scheduling operation, Mrs. Culver. She's been with me a number of years. She's a professional at it and knows her business.
Yeah.
And she works with the local people to work it out, and it's all listed.
He'll probably, you won't be taking any phone calls.
No. I scold her once in a while. I say, Ursula, you forgot, that's Mrs. Culver's name. I said, you forgot to put down there that I should have lunch, or that I should have a chance to even, you know, go to the washroom. She gets the schedule lined up all day long, and I live by it, but not always living on time on it.
But you know, I often think I'm a very silly man to even think that, but I wonder, sure. And I worry about it.
Patch in here.
Never had a chance to ask you.
You want another song?
I live a fast pace, and I really can sit down and actually have a bottle of beer. Almost every night of my life, I have had cheese and crackers, or I like, believe it or not, diet root beer. A lot of times I drink that.
See if they clip that out of our program. But coming from the state you live in, of course, you'd have to like cheese and milk and so forth.
Yes, and last evening, Mrs. Humphrey and I were together in Tampa, Florida. We don't have as much time as we'd like on occasions such as a campaign. But we do have a good family life, to be frank about it, and we
because
have common
interests.
Because you
work at it? Because you work at it, Senator?
We work at it, and we trust each other, and we know that each one of us has a sort of a life of our own to live, but we also have a life together. We have a very close family, a very close family. Our daughter is now with Mrs. Humphrey for a few days, and my youngest son and his wife were with her down in Florida. Last week I was home in Minnesota, and my boys were with me. I'll never forget. Have you got a minute on it?
Oh, we got plenty of time.
You know, in 1964, at the Atlantic City Democratic Convention, my boys were there, and my daughter, Nancy, Skip, Bob, and Doug. And one of the TV cameramen came right on up after I had received the nomination for vice president. And my second son, Robert, is not he's not the political one. The oldest one is more so that way. In fact, the oldest son's going to run for the state senate right now.
Good
and
for
I think
him.
Do well.
Good for him.
But Bob has been more reticent. And one of the reporters came up to him, put that camera right on him, said, young man, what's your name? He said, Robert. He said, do you ever get to see your father, this busy life? And Bob is like his mother. He has great honesty. And he looked right in that camera without knowing it, I'm sure, and he said, well, we don't get to see Dad very often, but when we do, he said, we have a great time together. I tell you that when I heard that, the tears came down my face because the boy really spoke what I feel about it. We have a wonderful fellowship. We argue, we play roughhouse, for example, in the summertime, even at my tender age, I get out there and jump on the trampoline.
Do
skeet shooting. Swimming. We like to hunt together. In fact, this fall, I was out hunting with. We always go hunting. We go duck hunting and pheasant hunting. That's just a part of our fellowship as young people with the young people in the family.
You know, one thing that amazes me, Senator, if I might, is you have enormous powers of concentration. At 17, 18 minutes after 11 o'clock at night, you've had a long day. There are many things happening in the hall outside us, and yet you have great ability to absolutely concentrate on what's going on.
Yes.
I've heard people ask you on some of the bigger national news programs, you know, why do you want to be president? But could I ask you, at what age did you begin to say, no, I have something I want to give? Do you know when it took place, or was it a natural progression?
Well, I was luckier than some people in many ways. I've often talked to my dad, and he was a unique and really an unbelievable man, the most unforgettable man I'll ever know. I've written about him, and when I get more time, I'm going to do more writing about him. He was a businessman, but he was a civic man. He was the mayor of his town, little town. He was the council member in town, and he was a leader in the church work, and he didn't wear religion on his arm sleeve, but he was a regular man around town, and he was a Democrat, and it was hard to be a Democrat in South Dakota. He was Al Smith's campaign manager in 1928 when they were burning Ku Klux Klan crosses out there on the hills of South Dakota, and that's a fact.
That's a tough day.
I remember my father being threatened. As a young man, I remember my father receiving threats of physical violence to him in those days. Well, Dad, we always talked politics. My poor, sweet mother, who was the most marvelous and still lives, bless her heart, she was a great cook and a wonderful mother and homemaker. But we'd sit down and eat this food that Mom would cook for us. I don't think we ever knew what we were eating because Dad would be steaming up an argument with us, you know. So I grew up in politics. I grew up in reading biography. I grew up with my father talking about Roosevelt, when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president. Mm-hmm. My dad told me in 1928 that he remembered Roosevelt speaking at the convention in Houston. He drove all the way down in an old Chevrolet car from Dolan, South Dakota to Houston to go to the Democratic convention. That was his idea of a vacation.
That type of dedication, that's what I was trying to get at.
So I sort of grew up in it, and when I went to the university, I'll tell you why I went back to the university. I was in the University of Minnesota from 29 to 31, and then I had to check out the Depression, and I went out and studied pharmacy in a limited course and got my pharmacy degree. I decided to go back to the university, not to get a degree particularly, but I heard people talk out in South Dakota in politics, and I said, gee, if a fellow would just learn something, if he just go and study, he could really do a good job.
In other words, you've always been willing to pay a price.
So I went back. I got was married. We didn't have a dime, frankly. Mrs. Humphrey, I always joke about it and say that I married my scholarship because she had to, just to give you an idea what happened, we couldn't get it. You couldn't get a job if you were married in those days. This is 1937.
What do you mean you couldn't get it if you were married?
A woman. They weren't hiring women, married women.
Right.
So Muriel took off her wedding ring, and she went around Minneapolis looking for a job. And she finally got one with what is known as Investor Syndicate then. Now it's known as IDS. And she was a bookkeeper, and they paid $45 a month, whether we needed it or not. I was a registered pharmacist, and I worked in a drugstore in Minneapolis, Minnesota for 20 cents an hour. That was my wage scale as a registered pharmacist. And that's the way we got started in our academic life. Then when I was at the university, I became greatly interested in Minnesota politics. And I thought I might run for, one time I thought I might even run for city council, then I thought I might run for Congress, always had it in my mind. But I had a chance one time to run for mayor, and I grabbed it. First time I was defeated. Not much, just a squeaker. I've had some squeakers, so you know.
You have never been afraid of a fight, and you'd never seem to be too taken back by things that written about you, that you are a human man, Senator. Hasn't it ever bothered
you? With
all
the frailties, I know that, you know.
But doesn't that ever bother you? That must be a terrible weight for a family man.
Well, you know, nobody likes to read
things about you. To see some clown write something about you that isn't necessarily true.
Well, what they write about me, I suppose, has some truth. For example, I've been talking a lot here. I like to visit and converse.
That's why we asked you in here, though, Senator.
But it hurts sometimes when, you know, people say, well, you have to have a tough skin when you're a politician. That's not true. You're very sensitive as a politician. If you're a good politician,
you have to,
be very, very sensitive. But you have to learn how to take it. Harry Truman used to say, if you can't take the heat, you got to get out of the kitchen. I don't like to just use the word fight, but I persevere. If I believe in something, I stay with it. I may change course for a while, but I'm staying on what is the objective. And I think that's the way you get things done in this country. I don't believe in flash in the pan stuff. I don't believe in government by headlines. I don't believe that government by image. I really believe that ultimately that the people will reward character and perseverance and steadfastness and experience. Once in a while, somebody comes dashing through like a great hero, but most of us just have to work our way through it and try to learn as we go along.
We very much appreciate all your time. Look at these people. Look at these people. Now look at the triumphant that you have there.
I don't pay them. That you see out there. Now there they are. See those good friends out there.
Senator, I have to introduce a couple of men to you that I want to make sure that they have a chance to meet you, if only through glass. That's Bill Roberts, the gentleman in the middle, my technical director tonight. Does a great job for us. Bill Green sitting with a phone you've met before, and so often they never have a chance to meet people that come in. I know you're way behind schedule.
You
Senator.
Know who those characters are.
Please
out
tell
there.
Me. I'd like to know.
They're from out there from CBS, ABC, NBC, Minneapolis Tribune, a couple of them with me, two or three of my friends from the labor movement.
Well, can I say on behalf of Westinghouse that I hope they get lucky and get a job soon? They're just running around here at 11 o'clock at night.
You see, this is some of the unemployment that
now,
I'm talking about.
We're talking about how hard you work, Senator, but they really have a longer day than you because they've got to be up before and up after, huh?
You know,
how am I doing, fellas? How am I doing?
Yes.
Is it true that the senator has a bar on the plane, gentlemen? Can I
get
ask?
Get out of here, you guys.
Senator Walter Gloss, our engineer for many years here
Hello,
at KDK.
Very nice to us, my wife and I, at Paris
Airport.
See? Thank you. When Mrs. Humphrey and I came
right.
through, I remember right. that I see yeah. you there.
We were with our boy and his wife.
Yes.
And his wife had been on a plane with you. She was a purser.
Yes,
and
yes.
Came over and introduced
yes,
you. Very nice
I
people.
Thank you very much. What a nice thought of you to remember
well,
that. Thank
nice
you.
That you remember it. I was sure you would.
Thank
you. Senator, thank you very
Give
much.
Give your listeners my best.
Will do.
Thanks.
Thank
Bye.
You for coming in, sir.
Got up and started marching around, leading his own private parade. That's Vince, isn't it? Yes. Well, Vince has told me that he's going to do this right down to the White House. He insists on being able to walk right on into the Oval Office. Dear friends, This is a joint enterprise that we're involved in. I know that many of you have come to my banner, have come to help me under considerable stress and strain. It has not been easy. Many of you have had pressures brought to bear. People say that you shouldn't do this, that you will have troubles and so forth, but you have stood the test. Now, let me just tell you that you might have gone through a bit of what we call a stormy winter, but there's going to be a beautiful summer and fall. I just want you to know that. Beautiful summer and fall. And very shortly, we'll have a nice spring in Pennsylvania. My schedule includes the next few days being in Florida, where Mrs. Humphrey is tonight. And believe me, she's doing a tremendous job for us. She has just campaigned throughout that state, and if you would see the good publicity that she's getting, I tell everybody that really that if they don't like me to vote for Muriel, that we come together. And she's doing a fine job. And after the primaries in Florida, we will, of course, go for a couple of weeks into Wisconsin. I've been in there, in and out of there. Things look good in Wisconsin. We were late to get started, as you know, but that doesn't bother me, because after all, what's important is what you do in the regular season, not in the, you know, not in the Grapefruit League or in the spring tune-up, so to speak. It's in the big events. And we have had wonderful reception out in Wisconsin. I want you to know, both in Florida and Wisconsin. Last Saturday night, I was in Wisconsin, and we had three big meetings, and they were packed houses, really and truly packed houses. And I want to thank my friends here from the labor movement that are here. They sponsored those meetings, two of them last week. Another was sponsored by one of the county committees, and overflow crowds, standing room only. And nothing do I like better than, you know, wall-to-wall people. Wall-to-wall people. Now, we'll be back in Pennsylvania intensively from one end of this state to another, starting right after the April 4th primary election in Wisconsin. I want you to know that I intend to campaign this state with all the vigor and vitality and enthusiasm at my command, and that's quite a little. I want you to know we've got quite a little of it. So get yourself ready. Start taking vitamin pills. You can always buy them at Humphrey's Drugstore. I mean, got to get in my commercial. But truly, this is an effort where all of us are going to have to pitch in. I want you to feel like you're running for president. I want you to feel like this is your fight, not just mine. And it is your fight. Believe me, it is. And I am a full-time, regular Democrat. You know that not only do I have the desire that I should win, but I have, more importantly, the desire that the party shall win. I mean that if fortune shouldn't shine upon me, every person in this room knows that Hubert Humphrey never walks away from a fight, and Hubert Humphrey isn't going to be going to take off on some tangent. I'm going to be in there backing my party, backing whomever our convention nominates. Of course, I do better when it's for myself. If you want the best, I do better. But we're going to be regular party people to work for the victory of a Democratic slate, president and vice president, in November of 72. I just sincerely believe this, that we cannot take, for the good of this country, four more years of the kind of lackadaisical, frontline, publicity-seeking, primetime television government that we've had in Washington. And I know that we can. So let's not just think about a party victory. In many a meeting, I have read the undelivered address, the final words of John Kennedy, when he pointed out that this is no time for pettiness, that our cause is great, and we cannot afford to be petty or to be divided, that we have great things to do, and truly we do. There are many things to do in this great country of ours. And what I said to the labor meeting this morning of the AFL-CIO, I meant not just as a political speech, but as a true commitment of one human being to another. It is wrong. It is wrong, and it is immoral, it is uneconomic, it is sad when a person is without a job that wants a job in this country. And it is wrong that we don't take care of better care of our elderly in this country. And it is wrong that some of our people are forced to live in filth and degradation in slums and ghettos in this country. And I am resolved, no matter what my position is, to change it, because we can do it. I know what can be done in this country. I've been around here a good long time. I've been mayor of a city, senator, vice president. I think I know what can be done. And I want you to know something else. If they tell you we can't win, which is the, you know, that's the opposition's line, I think you ought to know. The first time I ran for mayor, I didn't make it. The second time I did, and believe me, I made it. The first time I sought the vice president, not presidential nomination, I didn't make it. The second time I did. The first time I sought the presidential nomination, I didn't make it. The second time I did. The first time I ran for president, I didn't make it. And the second time, we will. Thank you very much.
Cowards, because you're not. And I know that many times you get in a box that maybe the easiest thing to do is send it back to committee.
Into a unit so that their dues can be collected and the organizational structure can be set up whereby their leadership is established. So I urge you not to send this bill back to committee.
Well, please retire to the out the front door, Senator, and escort the distinguished former vice president and United States Senator, Senator Humphrey, to the rostrum. Remind him of the 10 minutes. It's a distinct pleasure to present to the members of the Florida Senate the former Vice President of the United States, distinguished member of the United States Senate, Senator Hubert Humphrey.
Well, Mr. President, I'm highly honored to be permitted by the courtesy of this distinguished body to say a few words to members of the State Senate of the great state of Florida. May I first of all say that it's always good to see a fellow senator, and I feel very much at home in a body like this. I want to express my thanks to, through you, to the people of Florida for the generous and warm hospitality that you've extended to Mrs. Humphrey and myself in our days here during the presidential primary. Really, we have enjoyed every minute of it. We've learned a great deal. This is in many ways a new experience for us, despite the opportunities that I've had as a public servant to learn a great deal about our country. Florida represents in so many ways what's happening in America. It represents the tremendous growth, the intensity of that growth, the problems that come with mobility of people. You have all of the challenges and the problems that come with an urbanized society in the fields of agriculture. You have here the black, the white, the rich, the poor, the urban, the rural. You have all the many challenges that come with science and technology. I think that one could say that Florida is America in, not in miniature, but in a pattern that tells us much about what we face and much about what we can do. I want to compliment you of the legislature, particularly here of this honored body, your distinguished governor, and all of those that serve you for the work that you're doing. I'm not unfamiliar with the difficulty of the legislative task of trying to find answers that even please a majority of the people, much less that please all of the people. But I don't think our job is always just to please. I think our job is mainly to do what we believe ultimately is right. Sometimes people do not see that at the moment, but nevertheless, we have responsibilities as governmental officials, as legislators, to look just a little bit beyond the moment. You have a very significant primary here, and the decision to be made by the people of this state on March 14th, I believe, will have an impact on the American people in this election year. And I thought, in the time that you've permitted me to have, I'd just share with you in the broadest general terms the message that I'm trying to bring to your state. First of all, I bring a message of congratulations, because I think you are really dealing with some of the tough problems. And while there's a good deal of struggle, and that's what makes the headlines, there's also a good deal of progress. The message that I've tried to bring is not always heard, as your message isn't, nor is it always noticed in the competition of new voices. But it is a message that the time has now come for the people's government to get on with the work of building this country. We have so many people today that tell us all of our mistakes, all of our weaknesses, but have very few solutions. So many people today that think that the way they prove themselves to be intellects, prove themselves to be prophets, is just to recite the litany of our weaknesses, of our disabilities. I happen to be an optimist about this country, and I am interested primarily not only in finding out what is wrong, but trying to right the wrongs within the limits of our time and our resources. I mention this because the events of the past week, I think, tell us something that we need to think about in some depth. The president has reminded us that we're in tough competition as he returned from China with China. He'll soon remind us that we're in tough competition with the Soviet Union, and you don't need to be reminded, you are. We're in competition with everybody in the world, and not just economic. And might I add, that competition is not only tough in many places, it's been winning. But the competition goes beyond the economic. It's a competition of ideas and ideals, and it's a competition of how we find out to make ways and means to make government responsive to the needs of people. Now that's what this country's all about. We the people. And you're right here close to the people. I happen to believe that if we're to do the job that we want to do, we have to be what we call one nation. We have to find some common cause, and we have to have a degree of unity. And we must learn to live together. And part of that learning takes place right in our educational system. Building a better America starts right out in first-class quality education, accessible and available for all of our children, no matter race, creed, color, sex. And I have to say it here, as I've said it elsewhere, that quality education, availability of it, accessibility to it, is the issue. This is the real challenge, not busing. Slum schools and slum neighborhoods, poor schools with poor people, means poor education. An integrated education system with modern facilities, well-trained and competent teachers, produces what you and I want, quality education. I don't think there's any parent, black or white, who wants his or her child in an inferior school. So the emotional issue, the one that grabs the headlines, I know what it is. I've been in politics a long time. It's the busing issue. just as one time it was communism, as another time it was Vietnam. But the needs of America go far beyond the school bus or the school driver or the bus driver. I happen to believe that the decade of the 1970s must be a decade of dynamic domestic development for this country, a period where we take care of ourselves, where we start to put the resources of this country to work for the American people. I happen to believe we can help no one else until we get our own house in order. And we've been helping the whole world, and the time has now arrived for the American people to take stock and to do what needs to be done here at home. What I'm talking about is work, jobs, the ability to earn and to save, and to do it without the fear of an economic catastrophe that robs us of everything. I think that building a better America means tax reform. You've done some of it here in your own corporate tax system. I think it means closing loopholes that are really nothing more or less than special privilege that place undue burden upon middle-income America and low-income America. I think it means the relief of the property tax as best as we can. And I think it means that the people must share in the national prosperity. And I believe this building a better America is something we've talked about all along the line. Air pollution control, water pollution control, yes. But what about the pollution of our social environment? Slums and ghettos, and the pollution of our minds by prejudice and bitterness. I think that pollution is even more serious than the pollution of the physical atmosphere. And I think building a better America means real economic justice and security for over 20 million of our elderly, who today are the victims of cost of living increases and inflation, who have been given far too little concern by their government. And it means, frankly, right now a 25% increase in Social Security benefits at a minimum. It means really making Medicare work. And it means lifting out of poverty over 5 million beneficiaries of old age, the blind and the disabled, who today are living on really on a miserable pittance. They ought to have enough to live on. And building America means continuing our vital space program. And let me say, as the chairman of the Space Council for 4 years, I understand this program. And it means the space shuttle, gentlemen. And it means keeping this space program going because it's the new dimension of science and technology. And this nation will cut back at it on the space research at its own peril. I think it's a wise investment. And I think building America also means fighting the enemy from within, crime and drug abuse. The first duty of government is to give people safety. There's no excuse on the part of government for the lack of law enforcement. And law enforcement is not a word or a phrase to be shunned. It's the first responsibility to give people protection, safety in the streets, in their neighborhoods. And I think also building a better America means making street-level government work, where we live, getting the revenues down to where we live, understanding that most of the government that affects our lives takes place right in our own community. Now, all of this is what I've been trying to tell your people, from Pensacola to Miami, and I hope to go to Key West. But today we know that devotion is not enough. Caring is not enough. Only commitment backed up by action is enough. But action will be slow in coming to any part of our country. It'll be slow in helping us move forward if we're divided. Now, if we're a divided nation of rich against poor, north against south, and young against old, and black against white. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the oldest politics. It's the politics of yesterday. We've got to get over it. We are going to need each other as we've never needed each other in our lives. When I see the president coming back from a journey thousands of miles to a strange country and a strange people and a great people, and when he tells me that there's going to be great competition, I have to say to you, we better find each other and understand that we need each other in this country. Who knows what the tomorrow will bring? Who will stand with us tomorrow? Who will help us? So may I just finally suggest then that we do not yield to those who play upon differences. of religion or race or sex or income. We need to reject the counsel of those who seek to divide us, those who use the tactics of hate and fear, those who seek to reverse our progress towards true equality of opportunity. Theirs is the message of despair, but America needs the message of hope. The strength of this nation is in its people, educated, healthy, proud, confident, and united in respect of our diversity and finding common cause in our goals. Let me quote to you Carl Sandburg as if it would be a benediction for my message. Carl Sandburg, the people's poet, he speaks my thoughts. I see America, said Sandburg, not in the setting sun of a black night of despair ahead of us. I see America in the crimson light of a rising sun, fresh from the burning creative hand of God. I see great days ahead, great days possible to men and women of will and vision. My fellow legislators, that's the message of optimism and confidence that this country needs. Not despair, but a sense of vision, the sense of great days ahead, the sense of America coming alive, and not an America of self-pity, but an America of pride, an America that wants to do better. That's what I'm talking about. I'd like to be president. But let me tell you what I'd even rather do, to lift the spirits of this country, to get us moving again, to get us thinking about the tomorrows, rather than wringing our hands about the past. Thank you very much.
Condone or agree to this type of thing
and start and embark upon a precedent that we're going to censor.
Distinguished guest with us today, former mayor of Minneapolis, Minnesota, distinguished United States Senator from Minnesota, Majority Whip, Vice President of the United States, and now U.S. Senator from Minnesota, past Democratic nominee for the presidency, 1968, the Honorable Hubert Humphrey.
Thank you. Very gracious introduction, thank you. Mr. Speaker, my very sincere thanks to you and the members of this body for the courtesy which has been extended to me today to speak to you briefly on matters which I hope are of mutual concern. As I listened to your introduction, I couldn't help but feel in this time of the movement of what we call ecology that you are witnessing and looking upon a product of recycling. I know all the pains of the what we call being a freshman senator and all the joys of seniority. And now I have a mixed blessing of a little of both. May I first of all express my very sincere thanks on behalf of Mrs. Humphrey and myself for the many courtesies which have been extended to us in our visit to Florida. We've had a wonderful time. It's been a learning experience for us. We've traveled throughout your beautiful state from the southern tip up into the panhandle to Pensacola. We have been in the rural areas and in the urban areas. We've seen your vast natural resources, and we have seen all the wonders of a state that's in great transition. I would imagine that it would be fair to say that Florida represents in a sense in a pattern the tremendous changes that are taking place in the United States, possibly with greater intensity. You're urban, you're rural, you're north,
your South. You have rich, the poor, the black, the white, the Indian, the Latin, the Spanish speaking. You have America here. And I can't think of a better place for a man in public office to study, to learn, and to become intimately acquainted with many of the difficulties that face us and also many of the promises that lie ahead. You have given us the opportunity here as some of the potential nominees, as we call them, to test our ideas in your presidential primary. This primary is important. It may not be the alpha and the omega of the Democratic Party, but it is a significant primary, and the decisions that will be made here, I think, will have an impact on the American people in this election year. And in the time that you permit me to have, which is most generous on your part, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the message that I've been trying to give. You know, sometimes it's hard to get our message either noticed or heard in the tumult and the noise of the time and the many voices that compete for attention. But my message is built around one theme, of how once again to activate government to be responsive to human need. There are three words in the Constitution of the United States that stand out above all others. We the people. And it is my judgment, after having been in public life for some time, that government tends to want to serve government, and that we the people sometimes are forgotten. I believe that's why there's a restlessness in the country today. I believe people are really asking how we make government more responsible and responsive. And I'll tell you what else I think they're asking. When are we going to get down to the business of repairing the damage in our own country, or of righting the wrongs, or doing what ought to be done? In other words, building, creating a better America. We hear a great deal these days about how we're going to take care of people. And I'm considered to be one of those that's interested in that responsibility. But it is my judgment that most people want to take care of themselves if they have an opportunity. I've often said, and I repeat here, that a government that can do everything for you can do anything to you. What we need is a program not merely of promise, but of commitment. Not merely concern, but action to build this country. And we know where it needs building. The president's just returned from a visit to China. As he stood there at Andrews Air Force Base, he reminded us that we were in tough competition. He said the Chinese believe in their system. At least that's what he told us, even though it's a totalitarian system, a rigid ideology, a closed society. I think we have to know what our system is and believe in it. It's a system in which individual identity is precious, but in which we seek common goals and common cause, in which there's respect for diversity, but which there must be some semblance of unity. It's stated so beautifully in the Pledge of Allegiance, which I often have told my students as I taught, was not the statement of what America is, but is the statement of what America can be and should be. Now, I'm not going to spend my time on telling you what we could have done and should have done or where we were. I prefer to speak about what we can do and what we must do and where we're going. Because if people that spend their time on the history of yesterday except to learn from it are really living in the past, what we need to do is to look to the future and to understand that we are in competition, not just economic competition. I didn't like it the other day when I read that the Soviet Union, for example, produced more steel than we produced, because I heard Mr. Khrushchev tell me that he would do that as I sat with him in 1958 for 8 hours.
And he said, by the 1970s, Senator, we will outproduce you in steel. And they did. But it isn't just economic competition where we're, by the way, slipping. It's the competition of ideas, the competition of ideals, and whether or not we can make government and other institutions, all institutions, really serve people. The first objective of our system is equal opportunity. Equal opportunity. I'll never forget a time I was on Moscow radio, and there was a translation, and I talked about, used the word opportunity, and they had trouble finding a word that could properly describe that word, a word in the Russian. Opportunity is at the heart of the American system. Equal protection of the laws at the heart of the entire American system. And I think that one of the places we start with it is with education. And I do not run away from the issue. Building a better America does mean first-class quality education for all of our children. And let's start talking about children, not black, not white, not brown, but children. And think of them as the precious, precious asset of our country. And that's why quality education is the issue. Good education, not buses, not how many, not how many drivers, but quality education. Because you and I know that slums and slum schools and segregated education is poor education. And you and I know that good neighborhoods and decent neighborhoods and jobs and decent homes with good schools integrated with good facilities and competent teachers is quality education. And there is no other way out. No parent, black or white, wants his child to attend an inferior school, and the nation can't afford it. We're in competition. And I happen to think that the time is coming very shortly when we may very well have to stand alone. I don't know how long we can depend on old friends, particularly when we're not sure about how good we're going to be to old friends. Maybe we'll need each other, and maybe therefore we ought to develop every capacity that we have. The emotional issue is, of course, since I just come from Washington yesterday busing, but the needs of America go far beyond a school bus, far beyond it. The decade of the 1970s has got to be our decade of development. We've helped the whole world now for 25 years, poured out our resources, our manpower. I suggest to you, my fellow legislators, that the time has come for a decade of domestic development for Americans to protect our own country, to build our own country. If we can have a World Bank for the rest of the world and an Inter-American Development Bank and an Asian Development Bank to loan money to cities and states and provinces all over the world, 40 years, low-term, long-term loans and low rates of interest, why can't you have it for Tallahassee? Why can't you have it for Miami? Why can't we have the same thing for Minneapolis or St. Paul? I think we're a better credit risk, and I think there are great things that need to be done. There is no excuse for unemployment in this nation. We have things to do, things to build. Every person ought to have a job. We ought not to pride ourselves on the fact that we do well in welfare. We ought not to pride ourselves on the fact that we provide extended unemployment compensation. Those are but band-aids upon a body politic that is suffering from bruise and disease. What we need to do is to build, to create, and we've got things to do. We've got the manpower, we have the money, we have the technology. All we need to have is a sense of vision. We need to do something about taxes in this country. You started it here in your own state with your corporate tax revision. The loopholes in the federal tax system are an outrage. An outrage. Middle-income America is paying an undue burden of that tax. And it's time that somebody had enough courage to blow the whistle upon what I call the glaring special interest loopholes in the federal tax laws that leave some people paying far too much. We talk about pollution of the air and the water. We can do something about it. Listen, we can put to work our unemployed space workers in pollution control, air and water, make no mistake about it. But the greatest pollution that we have is of the mind, the pollution of the social environment. the slum, the ghetto, rural poverty, of which this nation is literally loaded. We can clean our minds of prejudice and bitterness, and building a better.
Delegates carrying the signs to please take their seats so that we might get underway. I hope you will understand and cooperate with the chair.
Kenny O'Donnell are on the platform.
I got it right here.
Attaboy. James Brown is a musky man. You don't know what you should make this movie. He's a musky man.
Yeah.
you. Good to see you, too.
Larry, later on, if you want to introduce these three fellows.
I know. When you're born. When you're born.
Delegates with the signs will please be seated. Convention will be in order. With us this morning, and I am delighted, as I'm sure all of you are the top executive administrative officers of the United Steelworkers of America, President Abel, Vice President Joe Maloney, and Secretary Treasurer Walter Burke. In addition, as all of you, I am sure, noticed, former Governor George M. Leader, and Ken O'Donnell, who I understand operates the Washington Central Headquarters of the Campaign Committee for the Senator. But delighted to have him present. And now it is my privilege and distinct honor to perform a chore. Brings back some reminiscences, as I'm sure many of you will recall also. 4 years ago at our convention in this hotel in Pittsburgh, he also spoke. And at that time, in a different capacity, as the Vice President of the United States. He and his running mate, Senator Muskie, who addressed us by telephone communication earlier today, they came within a cat's whisker of becoming the President and Vice President of the United States. Very much of that was attributable to the members and leadership of organized labor, and especially was that significant in Pennsylvania, where you couldn't have got anybody to think that Humphrey could do it. But he did, and many of you helped immeasurably in that undertaking. Now that a senator is tremendously busy, as are all of the other candidates aspiring for the nomination, and it accords me a personal privilege, which I'm sure I express, and an honor on behalf of all of you present this morning, to introduce, to address the convention, the United States Senator Hubert Humphrey.
It's always nice to get good advice. First, may I express to Harry Boyer a very deep and sincere thanks for presenting me to this convention. And may I also express to the officers of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO an everlasting note of thanks for friendship and devotion and loyalty and support far beyond the call of duty. I'll never forget it. And come what may in the years to come, you have a first-class, all-time, lifelong friend in Hubert Humphrey. And I want to especially thank my friends of the steelworkers who joined us here today. I want to thank Mike Johnson, who is your very gifted and talented and hardworking director of the COPE operation. And let me tell you that the COPE operation is one of the most effective political instruments in American politics. Keep it going. Put those $2 in, not those $1. After all, Nixon's got the prices up, you know. We've got to go to town. Every time I look at Mike and know that his title is vice president, I have a tear for him, and I understand his problems. I see how healthy Harry looks, how harried Mike looks, and it reminds me of days when I served in similar capacity. And the same thing is true of Joe Maloney, but I want to say this, that if you've got to have a vice president, it's good to have his name Maloney or Johnson, one or the other. I wonder how that would have sounded if I'd said that 4 years ago. I remember those 4 years ago. I remember being in this hall, and I remember the wonderful reception that you gave to me. And I remember the enthusiastic support and the endorsement that you gave to me. And I went from this great convention back to Washington, D.C., knowing that no matter what else ever happened, that there was a body of support for a Democratic candidate, and that that support would not fail, that it wouldn't be the support of just one day a week. It would be a seven-day, all-time support, and you surely delivered. And to every one of you, with my friend Abe Abel here, and Harry Boyer, and your new, by the way, I want to pay my respects to the man that I understand will be Secretary Treasurer. I wouldn't want to miss that, Bob McIntyre and others. I just want to say thank you very, very, very much. It was mentioned here a moment ago that there's a gentleman on this platform, too, that I want to call attention to. First of all, my chairman here in the state of Pennsylvania, I think one of the best men that ever served you, a man that was your loyal friend and a trusted, great public servant, one that stood with us all the time, and that's Governor George Leader, and he's my leader here. I'm proud of him. But some of you in this room may recall the great primary battle of 1960. There were just really two candidates in that primary. Somebody had to give the man that was going to be president his spring training, and I was selected for the responsibility. We went out into Wisconsin, and we went into West Virginia, and the campaign manager, the man that was closest to the man who was to become president of the United States, is on this platform with us today. John Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey fought it out like men should fight, clean, tough, with intelligence and with complete dedication. And out of that great primary campaign came a candidate that carried the banner of our political party, the Democratic Party, with honor and with distinction and with all the spirit that was required. And the man that stood by his side in the presidency and was his closest compatriot is today the man that's by my side. And I want this audience to know that this man standing before you now has as his ambition and his desire and his commitment to pick up the torch that was struck down from the hands of John Kennedy by the assassin's bullet, and to carry that torch of getting America on the move once again, and I think that we can do it. Now, friends, you're fortunate today. Ordinarily, I give you one of those real good ones, you know, where I get wound up and then rewound. But I do have to go back to Washington. I'm happy to tell you that I'll be able to be back there in time to take care of the matters that are coming before the Senate of great concern. We start our major voting at 2 o'clock this afternoon, and I'll be there to take care of it. Don't you worry about that. And I'll be there to represent the interests of the people of the United States. ...1968, we won't relive it long, I'll just simply say this, that we came close enough to surprise our friends and frighten our opposition. We came so close, didn't we, that it was, as Harry Boyer said, like a cat's whisker. You know, somebody once asked me, what do you think cost you the election? Well, there was too big a list for me to mention. But I said one thing, I thought we ran short of time, just a little more time. That would have might have helped, but who knows? But I remember what Vince Lombardi, that great coach of the Green Bay Packers, once said, when they were right down on the 1 foot yard, on the 1 foot line, ready to score a touchdown, they needed that touchdown for the victory. They'd come 97 miles down the field in a series of plays. Things were moving just as they were in 1968, and just as the quarterback was going to call the signal for the last play, the referee blew the whistle. And one of the young reporters come rushing up to Lombardi with a kind of a glint in his eye, knowing that this time the good old coach would have to admit that he'd had it. And they said, this reporter said to him, well, Coach Lombardi, what do you have to say about your defeat? And Lombardi looked him right in the eye and he said, listen, young man, we weren't defeated. We just ran out of time. That's all we did. We just ran out of time. My fellow Americans and my friends of the American labor movement, we weren't defeated. We just ran out of time. And I think that an election that was as close as that one where we were just getting wound up and warmed up, I think it deserves a rematch. And I intend to give it to them. Now let's lay it on the line in labor terms. I've served my apprenticeship. I think you know that. I have some seniority. I think you know that. And I come to ask you, as my bargaining representatives, members of my union, I come to ask you to help me so that I might become the President of the United States, your President. But whatever it may be, and no one can predict, how do we know what tomorrow will bring? But above all, far beyond my personal ambition in this, I have a greater ambition. And that is to see that the man who today is in the White House and who has been there for 3.5 years, that the lease on that White House comes to an end, and that Nixon is through in 72. That's the job. He will have had his time. He will have had his time. Hold it there. We'll get going here a little later. Nothing like an enthusiastic supporter. The president will have had his opportunity to have seen the Great Wall of China. He will have had his opportunity to have gone into the walls of the Kremlin. And now I think he ought to have his opportunity to retire in California. That's where he belongs. Now let's get right down to business. Why do I say this? I have a great respect for the office of the presidency, and I hope every American does. My comments are not directed towards the office, because the office represents the hopes and the desires, the dreams of the American people. And that office must be occupied by someone that is sensitive to the needs of the American people, someone that feels the pain of a citizen that's in trouble, someone that senses the hopes of a young man or a young woman that looks to the future, someone, if you please, that can understand the anguish of a person that's unemployed and can't find a job. That office must be occupied by someone who understands that the future of America is in its children, that understands that the test of our compassion is in the way we treat our elderly, that understands that the test of our true decency is the way that we treat those that are unfortunate, the sick and the handicapped. We must have somebody in that office that understands that the strength of this nation is not in the money in its banks, nor is it in the cutting edge of its military, but that the strength of this nation is in the health and the education and the well-being and the spirit of the American people. This nation doesn't need someone that just understands the machinery of government, as the present occupant does. This nation needs someone that understands the people of the American nation, that understands their hopes, that understands their worries. And the American nation today needs an uplift as it never needed it before in all of its history. This nation is tired because it has not been called to action. This nation is apathetic because there is no clear signal as to what to do. There are millions of our people today that are standing idle, that beg for work. And what is the answer of this administration? More welfare, more unemployment compensation. That's not what we want. That may be a temporary palliative. That may be the pain reliever for the moment, but it doesn't cure the disease. And I submit to you that America will never be able to compete. As the president said when he came back from China, he said, we are now engaged in a mighty competition. And believe me, we are. They're tough, a rigid ideology, a closed society. They know what they want. And he said, we're going to have peaceful competition. All right, Mr. President, if we are, then I give you the first rule of competition. Let every American, regardless of race, creed, color, or sex, have something to say about this country. Put every American that can work, that wants to work, put him to work. Protect the American job. Protect the American worker, Mr. President, and you'll have a strong country. I'll say we're in for tough competition. And we're not only in for competition with the Chinese, which is the new fad, but we're in competition with the Soviet Union, which, by the way, my friends of the steel workers, for the first time in the history of the world, outproduced us in steel production. I don't like it. I don't like to come in second best in anything, including elections. I'll say we have competition. We have competition from Europe. We have competition from Japan. And the competition is not only economic, it's across the board. How best do we take care of people? I believe in our system. I believe in a system of we the people. I believe that government, by the consent of the governed, can work. But in order for it to work, there has to be people in government that tap this mainspring of the strength of this nation. Tap the talent of the people. Oh, Mr. Nixon, Mr. President, you have got us on the sort of a roller coaster, the uppers and the downers, as they say in the drug culture. You know, when we talk about drugs today, we talk about hard drugs. We talk about marijuana. We talk about uppers and downers. I'm a pharmacist first, and I know a little bit about them. Listen, the uppers and the downers of Dr. Nixon. The cost of living is up. The jobs are down. Unemployment is up. Income is down. Budget deficit is up. Taxes for big business are down. Imports are up. Exports are down. Interest rates are up. Investments are down. Mortgages are up. Payments are down. Welfare rolls are up. And revenues are down. There's your uppers and downers. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're on a roller coaster like that, you're dizzy from beginning to end, and you can't compete, and you know it. $183 million tons of steel. Wait a minute, 18,300,000 tons of steel, I should say. 18,300,000 tons of steel imported into this country, which meant 100,000 jobs of steel workers. You can't buy a radio or a television set that's American made anymore. In fact, one of these days, you're going to have to read Japanese to have it fixed. Whether it's shoes or textiles or electronics or clothing or steel or rubber, we're supposed to somehow or another stand back and say, it's just fine. Is that competition not for me? Let me tell you how I compete. I believe in going out and trying to win. Maybe we can't win, but I want to try. I'm not going to sit back and play dead. And I'm here to tell this audience that it's time that we in America, with all of our responsibilities around the world, understand that the only way we're going to be able to help anybody else in the world is first to help ourselves. Start taking care of this country. I hear people say to me, well, what are we going to do about our cities? What are we going to do about the ghettos? What are we going to do about slums? What are we going to do about jobs? I got a program for you. There are things to do in this country. Airports to build. Schools that are needed. There are airports that there are community centers that are needed. Hospitals that are needed. Industries that are needed. Streets to be widened. Whole communities to be rebuilt. Houses to be constructed. Slums to be cleared out. I can list it on, give you a list as long as your arm of things to do. Over here are 6 million people without work. All of them have worked once in their life. They're not ne'er-do-wells. These are people that know how to work. 250,000 of them. Scientists, technicians, and highly skilled workers. The largest unemployed skilled labor force in the world. Over there are 6 million of them. Over here with more money in the banks than ever in our history. In between here, an America that cries out for things to be done, and a government that sits around like a stunned ox, unwilling to move, unwilling to put capital and labor together to rebuild a modern America. I want to get on with the job. We do it for everybody else. We rebuild every city in Western Europe. We bombed the cities of Germany in World War II. We sent our capital, our technicians, and our supplies and rebuild every city in the 1950s. We bombed the cities of Western Europe. They were broken up by fire and bomb. Every one of them rebuilt and modern. Listen, my fellow Americans. If we could rebuild the broken down old cities of Western Europe with American capital, with American technology, with American supplies, are you going to tell me that millions of our people have to live in filth and degradation in the inner cities of America? I say no. I say let's get on with the job. We have a World Bank to help everybody. An Asian Development Bank. We have an Inter-American Development Bank. We'll loan money to Rio de Janeiro 40 years at low rates of interest. but you can't get a dime for Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. I say that's wrong. I say that if you can rebuild a city in Africa or Asia or Latin America, you can do it right in Pennsylvania, in Allegheny County, or you can do it any place across the United States. And then they say, but how are you going to pay for it? By putting people to work? Did you ever hear anybody paying taxes on welfare? That can't be done. But I want to say for the Nixon administration, they got more people on welfare than any time in the last 15 years. They've done well, fairly well. Oh, yes, but they haven't put many people to work. And that's what's wrong in this country. Unemployment is not only an economic tragedy, it's immoral. When there are things to do, it's a human tragedy. And I don't intend to stand idly by as a citizen, a senator, a candidate for president or president and let it happen. The tax structure of this country, the federal tax system. Wake up, workers. The federal tax system is rigged against you. It's rigged against the working family and the working man. It's against the wage earner. It's against the average family. Let me just give you an indication. Less than 2% of the people receive 22% of the money in this country, and they pay less than 10% of the tax. But the working family, making between $8,000 and $15,000 a year, and that covers most of us, make 20% of the total national income and pay 36% of the tax. 36% when you make 20% of the income. When you make 22% of the income, you pay 10% of the tax. It's wrong. You know what you need? You need a president that has the guts to stand up for the average man. A president that has the courage to say that these loopholes that are big enough to drive a Mack truck through will be closed. And to see that the average man and woman in this country that works hard for the hourly wage, the weekly wage, the monthly salary check, that that person gets a fair break and a fair deal from the government of the United States. So I now must leave you. But as I do, I want to tell you what I think we can do. Together we can do everything. I've been your man. I've been with you in good days and bad days. I started my political career with you. In the very first days, the great Philip Murray and others, the great Bill Green and others, when I started my political career, the endorsed, labor-endorsed mayor of Minneapolis, in every election, we have walked together and we have worked together and we've built this country together. You've been in the front line of social progress and I've been out there leading, standing alongside of you. I'm no Johnny come lately. Everybody today is for civil rights. Where were they when the fighting was on? Where was it when it was tough? Every candidate today says, I'm for Medicare. Where were they when I introduced the first bill in 1949? Not to be found, hiding. Everybody says today in the Democratic Party, I'm for national health insurance. Well, I was for it in 1950. I started early. Some people said I was ahead of my times. No, some people just didn't catch up. Now they've caught up, some of them, but I want them to know that I'm moving ahead. I'm not going to stand still. Never have and don't intend to. I may not be the front runner, but I'm the distance runner, dear friends, and I'll be there to break the tape. Thank you very much.